stupid title is, and then I put Aardvarken elements in the title, but it's exactly the same. Okay, I have to apologize for a number of you that you have heard this talk several times in some version or another, but I know this is a different and more mixed audience, so and I'll try to do it in a different way. Namely, I will focus somehow on the three probability aspects on it, and only in the very end come with the applications to invariant subspaces. I usually do it the other way around, to talk about invariant subspaces, and never really get around to talk about the free probability that is involved. So, okay, so it's based on a number of papers. Can you read anything here? Okay. I'll also make it at least half blackboard. So I'll start out with blackboard for perhaps the first 25 minutes. Anyway, the history of Aardvarken operator, or the Aardvarken pairs, as it was called in the beginning, goes back to Nika and Spicer, and actually related to the Fields Institute. That was the last time there was an operator algebra, at that time of year, at the Fields Institute in Waterloo at that time, and that was published in the proceedings of that one. Together with a PhD student, I took it up in end of the around 90s. I don't know exactly when we made 19. In the late 19s, in the 90s, it must be, Fleming and I were able to compute the Brown's spectral distribution measure for these operators. And many years later, some years later, I found out that this setup somehow could be used to find invariant subspaces for rather general operators, and unfortunately there was one thing that has to be done, namely one has to extend it to unbounded operators. For some technical reason, we have to deal with unbounded operators, and that's so the main part of this paper, with first paper with Hannes Jules, is just redoing everything that had been done before for the bounded case to the unbounded case, including the proper definition of Caddis and Fourier determinant and Brown measure. And then finally in this, all these three are published. The last one came out just a couple of months ago in this special volume for Gerd Petersen in Mads Gandt. And the last one was put in the archive some 10 months ago, and still hanging. Okay, so let me take this one off if I can find out. Yeah, and one up. So I'll start out easy and talk about Reuchlinsky's R&S transform. Let me get some light on. Okay, thank you. Yep. Okay, everything can be done in a very general setting in algebra, but you need, for my money, I'll always work on a short called the C-star probability space, which means that this is a unital C-star algebra. And this is a state on A. And to avoid some, I'll always assume the state faithfully. It's usually not in the definition of C-star probability space, but just to avoid some stupid things. So you have, okay. Now, of course, for the Reuchlinsky defined distribution of an arbitrary element in algebra with unit as basically the set of moments. But if you are in the C-star setting, you are in the situation that you could get self-adjoint element, then these moments are given by a probability measure. Now in the existing unique measure, probability measure on the real line, we compact support such that the moment of A is equal to the integral of S to the n d mu A of S with the real line. So when I talk about distribution, I will always think of self-adjoint elements. I will think of the distribution as this particular probability measure. Okay, and if you have that these are two elements which are free in Wojtkowski's thing, since we are expected to phi, then Wojtkowski proves that this only depends on mu A and mu B. I here should take self-adjoint part, just stick to this and take it here. And it could be written like this, where this is an operation on this probability measure's compact support, and he found a way of computing this measure from the two measures. Namely, you start with the resolvent function, which is defined outside the real line, and then you simply define this one as the inverse of this one. Well, you have to take function inverse of this one in z minus 1 over 6, and this turns out to have a power series expansion in terms of the free equivalence, but let me just write this way. And having this, you have linearized the problem. If you have positive elements, you can do something similar with multiplication. The only problem is that this one in A will in general not be self-adjoint. However, if you look at phi to the A, B to the N, it's not hard to see. If you have three elements, then the phi restricted to the algebra generated by A and B is actually a trace, so you can write this as 1 half B, 1 half to the N. And this is a positive operator. So again, there exists a unique measure mu AB, namely the one we take with this operator, such that phi B to the power n is integral over the positive real line of S to the n g mu AB. Okay. And again, Wojtkowski proved that mu B only depends on these two, and so the operation needed to come from these two measures to this is called the free multiplicative convolution. And you found the way of linearizing this, or well, you have to take log of the S transform to get it linearized, but never mind. Namely, you have to look at the following function, psi of t to the integral from 0 to of ts divided by 1 minus ts of the mu a of s, which can also be expressed in terms of the resolvent function or G transform, something like that. And then you have to define the S transform like this. So at least in principle, it's possible to compute these methods often when run into to fairly tricky function and have to solve nonlinear algebraic equations. Okay. I haven't talked about trace now. The only thing is that I say for phi just a general state so far, and the reason that this works is that phi restricted to the algebra generated by two free cells for joint element is a trace. Okay, so all this works fine for self-adjoint operators. Of course, you can define the moments also for a non-self-adjoint operator, but of course, if you have a unitary where the spectral distribution is the uniform distribution on a circle, also called a high unitary, then all its moments are zero, so you cannot distinguish this unitary from the operator zero just by looking at moments. So, Nicke and Speiser set up introduced a multilinear R transform. So if you have A1 to AN in your algebra A, of course then you have the then you can look at moments and mixed moments in these A's, and based on that they defined I'll call it NS for Nicke Speiser. Such a R transform in these are complex variables, but they are non-commuting complex variables. And in general algebraic sense, this will just be a formal power series. Okay, and well, it also works in one dimension. One just has to be careful. If you take one dimension, then this one is the A is set times Voigt-Leskos R transform. So that's the only difference. Okay, but if you have a non-self-adjoint element, then you can look under pair A and A star. And so you can ask then this can be any such non-commutative complex room, and there is an algorithm to go from this, the coefficients of this, to the mixed moments of A comma A star. And they were looking for a particular case, namely they said that A is called R diagonal if this series has a special form. Some coefficient Cn and then set 1, set 2 to the n plus, and now one has to remember they don't commute, so this is a different one, this one. Okay, and as one can see from the title of the paper, it was they want to make a common approach to high unitary outbursts with uniform spectral distribution in the circle and Voiculescu circle element, which is this one over square 2S1 plus IS2, which is a semicircular system. And actually, if you take this operator C instead of A, you just get the first term. You get, you get Z1, Z2 plus Z2, Z1, plus within the normalization. But I mean, there's a much simpler way of expressing this in operator terms. Namely, if you have an operator, you can be written as UH, where UH are star free, meaning then U and U star, and H here, H and H star free. Okay, U should be high unitary, and H should be bigger than zero. Then A is R diagonal. And this is essentially the only example. If the kernel of A is trivial, then you can form the polar decomposition inside the given algebra, at least if you work in the phenomenal algebra. Let me see. Yeah. And so, to be precise, conversely, if A if A prime is R diagonal, then A prime has the same star distribution, meaning have all the same mixed star moments at A, where A is of the form A equals UH from 1. But the only place there is a problem is if the kernel is trivial, then you might have to go to a larger algebra to get such a free polar decomposition. Want to know how to operate with these operators. So if you have A and B, so this is okay, maybe I should say from now on, since these are such two operators will anyway generate, phi will be a trace on the suburb generated by this one. So from now on, we work in M comma tau, where M is a necessary finite phenomenal algebra, and tau is a faithful normal trace. I mean, it's not really any laws of generality when we talk about R diagonal operator, except that later on there was a generalization of this which worked in the non-trivial case, where I think you have to have different weights here and there. Okay. So if these are star-free R diagonal, then A plus B and AB are R diagonal, and there's a way to compute the distribution, and the distribution of I mean, just know the distribution of the absolute value of this operator. You know the whole thing, because we have this free polarity position given by... Take mu, a plus b, absolute value, and then I take a tilde, and then I just have to put here, mu tilde is 1/2 plus mu flip, so it's a symmetrized version. The symmetrized measure. That this you get simply by additive convolution, and if you take those and if you square them, then it, you can use simply the free multiplicative convolution, so they can be computed by R-Ness transform, and I think the story was that Fleming, Larsen and I discovered those two independently and found Nick Spicer's paper afterwards, but we made one thing that didn't happen, namely. Saying that, again, with if A is R-diagonal, then all powers R-diagonal. And you find the distribution of the absolute value part of R to the N by this rule that you take this one squared, and then you take the multiplicative convolution of this itself n times. So actually you get exactly the same R-diagonal element, up to star moments, as you would get if you took, instead of taking powers of the same R-diagonal element, took the product of n free identical distributed R-diagonal elements. Because then we'll follow from this one. So this is without the tilde. Did I? Yeah. Thank you. I missed that completely. Thank you. Okay, this is one way of dealing with, this R series certainly, one way of dealing with, say, the distribution of non-self-adjoint element. Another aspect is, what is the natural generalization of the eigenvalue distribution? If you have an n by n matrix, it has at most n eigenvalues, and you can, if you ask, associate, say, the number 1 over n or k over n if it has multiplicity k, root multiplicity k, then you'll get a distribution in a complex plane which will naturally should be called the spectral distribution. Certainly for self-adjoint elements, this probability measure is a good thing. But already in the normal case, we cannot use this, but in the normal case, one cannot, of course, do something else. So. Arbitrary. So, use mu A as above. If A is normal, then then you have the spectral resolution of A. For some projection valued measure, and you can simply take the define mu A to be the trace composed with this spectral measure. This will now be a measure with compact support, namely support equal to the spectrum of A in the complex plane, which generalizes this one up here. But what if it's not normal? When then Larry Brown come up with the right solution there. Well, I first need to. You need the Cartesian-Fourier determinant associated with a given trace. So this is a Fourier-Cartesian determinant. Quick way of writing it is to say that this is exp of the integral from 0 to infinity log, or natural logarithm, of t d mu absolute value of A, which is defined in this sense up here. So this will basically be the trace of the logarithm of the operator if it was invertible. Otherwise, you have to do it this way and then take x to that. So this is a and it's certainly multiplicative. But if you look at, say, the n by n matrix in the normalized trace, you will get the nth root of the absolute value of the determinant. So you don't get any base factor. And then Brown was able to prove that there exists precisely one. So A is an arbitrary element in M. M is now finite, and tau is a faithful trace. Probability measure in compact support in the complex plane, such that the logarithm of the Cartesian-Fourier determinant of A minus lambda 1 is given by the integral over complex plane log s minus lambda 1 d mu s d mu a of s for complex numbers. And this mu a generalizes both this one and this one. So I mean, we can use this terminology without getting in conflict with the previous ones. Actually, the way to obtain this one is that you can get mu a as the Laplacian of this function here. The only problem is that this may not be C2, it may not even be a continuous function, it will be a subharmonic function and therefore upper semi-continuous, so it has a Laplacian in the sense of distribution, that the Laplacian will be a positive measure, also called the Ries measure of that subharmonic function. And it gives what you want in the n by n matrix case. If you have a non-normal operator, say, with n distinct eigenvalues, then it associates the mass 1 over n to each eigenvalue, and that's it. Okay. Brown didn't really compute any examples, just set up the theorem. Fermi Larsen and I tried these R-diagonal operators as a test case and came up with the following. let's say this is an arc diagonal operator, and assume by, okay, we also were able to deal with the case where the cone was not trivial, but let's say this for simplicity, and A is not, so A is not a constant. So it's not proportional to how unitary. Then it turns out that mu A is uniquely determined by this one is invariant under rotation. That means Z goes to gamma Z, where this one has output value 1. The soup, support of this measure is an annulus or a disk, namely this particular disk. Well, this is well defined, this is just a square root trace A star A. This one I better define, this should be interpreted as this integral d mu A of t to minus 1/2, which may be infinite. And I need a third condition, which, well, no. Of course, when it's a rotation invariant, enough to tell what the measure is on open balls, and then you have to use the F transform of mu A square T minus 1, so you get T. So this specifies the radius you need to have to get that the mass of this ball is exactly T. But the F transform is a bijection on interval from minus 1 to 1, and actually this function here will go from between these two numbers when t goes from 0 to 1. So everything fits. What about the unbounded case? Of course, I think most people say, well, who cares? But I mean, we had a very, very good technical reason to care about the unbounded case. So we had to somehow redo a lot of the stuff in the unbounded case. A good part of it was already done by Vekulescu and Berkowitz, namely the Yarn S transform, and well, these two kinds of convolutions can be extended to probability measures on the fully realigned without compact support, and the same with this positive real line. So that works fine. And but what about the definition of R-diagonal element? Of course, the Nikas-Spicer approach will not work because there may be no moments at all defined. So one has to use its second way is gone. This is about polar decomposition. So yeah, maybe I should. Yeah, you can't. need to run these out. I'll switch the slides. Okay, so, well, we can do some more, can you see it, or should we dim the light a little bit more? Okay. So under the other elements, first of all, if you work in a finite phenomenon, well, with Facebook trace, it goes back to modern phenomenon, and there's no problem of dealing with unbounded operators. You can add them and multiply them with each other, and if you just close them off, you get actually a nice dialogue out of it. Unlike what happened if you work in B of 8. You can have two densely defined closed operators where intersection of the domains is zero. It never happens in the finite case. Okay. And then, to define R diagonal elements, we simply say that T should have the same star distribution as UH, where U is a high unitary and star free from a positive operator. Okay, and I didn't define what the star distribution is. Well, now you've got the light out. So I mean, I say two elements, S and C, unbound element, has the same star distribution. It's the smallest phenomenon, but that we affiliate with these two algebras are star isomorphic in a way that when you extend it to unbounded operators, it's then S to T. Again, for bounded operators, it is the same as having the same star moments. Okay, you're right. again, if you have two elements, S and C, in unbounded operators, you say that they are free if you look at star free, if these two subalgebras. The phenomena generated by uses the U in the polar decomposition and the spectral projections of the absolute value. I mean, these two phenomena are free. Yeah, by taking projections yeah. I mean that's absolutely standard to find the smallest phenomena for which a given unbounded operator is affiliated with. Okay, and then this is just a repetition of this, which was actually not only me and Lars, it was also Nikhil Spicer for the two first. And all this carry over to the unbounded case, where we use Berkowitz and Voigt-Koleski's definition. Now, the key example that we want to consider is coming up here, namely, you take a circular system. So, yeah, maybe I should have because I have to do a little more on this. I guess you all know what a semicircular system is, so let this be a free semicircular system. So this is basically the free analog of a four-dimensional Gaussian distribution, rotation invariant Gaussian distribution. And then you look at these two operators. This will be a star-free circular system in the sense of of Bart Blesko. So we have these two highly highly non-normal operators, but these are, so x and y are star free, and they are actually r-diagonal. And this implies that the kernel of y is zero, so you also get that x and y first are star free in this general sense, and also unbounded now are diagonal operators. And the operator we're interested in, this thing up here, named the closing of such two circle elements. And then you can simply use the whole machinery, use the, it's not hard to find the distribution way. The distribution x squared is 3 plus 1. You can also find the distribution this one. So just by manipulating the S transform, you will, and inverse filter transform, you'll get fairly quickly that this quotient x multiplied y inverse to the right will be then again r diagonal, and the absolute value follows this half Cauchy law. So it's just the Cauchy distribution where you have put all the weight to the right, and it turns out that it is has bounded p norm if p is between 0 and 1, but unfortunately not for p equal to 1. That would make life much easier, because L1 is a Banach space, LP for p less than 1 is not locally convex even. And another one, you can then use the resultant powers to get these diagonal elements to get a completely explicit formula for the p norm of this. And a third thing is that we are able to prove that if you take a power or set to the n and set to the minus n, I don't have to separate, because obviously set and set inverse have the same star distribution. It just corresponds to commuting x and y. So if you now take a resolvent of this in p norm, then basically by just using the set to the n is r diagonal. I need a little bit more, because this is actually false for high unit rules. Then you get this inequality. Okay, I think I will skip the proof, but I mean it's just using all the rules I already put up. And then the second thing we use is that, as you know, you all know from, put the line again, if you have a free semicircular system and make linear transformation of this given by a 4x4 orthogonal matrix, you get again a semicircular system. And passing this will turn, if you take a 2x2 unitary matrix and make a transformation of x and y according to such a unitary matrix, you will again get a star-free system of circular operators. So what's a bit surprising is that if you take a unitary where all elements are an M, and M is a phenomenon, but they're star free from the system X and Y, then it actually still holds that you get a star free circular system, and it's still star free from M. And this relies a lot of something I found in a paper of one of the earlier papers of Siatinko. I mean, basically you have to reduce everything this to free creation operators, and then you can do it. Okay, got some ink on it. And the next good thing about this operator is that if you now take such a unitary transformation of it, well, then with coefficients in M, then x, this one is x prime y prime inverse, well, x prime y prime is a new star free circular system, and this means that this new gadget has exactly the same star distribution as set itself. And so in particular, if you just take scalar 2x2 or SU2 matrices, you get an SU2 action on set, which also gives SU2 action on the spectrum of set. So it's okay. And one thing which we need is this particular inequality that this function is Lipschitz as a function of unitary U if P is less than 2/3. 2/3 is sharp, I mean it simply doesn't hold for P, the 2/3. And that has to do with, what do we have? The 2/3 come exactly from here, that we need this one from the square set minus 2, and this goes to 2/3 and not up to 1. Okay, but it takes about 5 pages to prove it, but it's each step in the proof is very elementary. You just observe that this, by using the fact that set and GU of set has the same star distribution, you will get that this metric, to get a metric I have to take to the power P, because the P norm itself doesn't satisfy the triangle inequality, it only satisfies it when rated to the power P, when P is less than 1. So this will actually turn out to be a right invariant metric, which is left invariant on the diagonal matrices, and then just playing with matrices, I can actually reduce it, or we can reduce it to the scalar case, and in that case, it turns out that you just have to use this inequality for this particular value of lambda. Okay, and having that, I think I'll skip a few slides, and you actually can get back to from that you can use this Lipschitz condition to get a Lipschitz condition on the operator. Any operator T, and you make a perturbation by this x divided by y inverse and a small number 1 over n instead, and can prove that this resolvent satisfy such a Lipschitz condition, again only for P less than 2/3. Okay, why is that important? Okay, I'll try to round it up. Okay, so let me finally, I mentioned invariants up to this, so let me just, so the main theorem we were after was this one, namely in every 2-1 factor, in every operator in that one, and every Borel set, there's a canonical subspace, T-invariant subspace, with the property that if you divide the Hilbert space according to this subspace and complement, you will have to have zero down there by invariants, and then the Brown measure of these two gadgets, which can be considered as operators in corn algebras, cut down with spectrum projection K and projection T. The Brown measure of this one will be concentrated in B, and the Brown measure of this one be concentrated in the complement. And there's only one such subspace affiliated with the Fanon algebra. It means that the projection down on is in the Fanon algebra. And it holds, I mean, without any restrictions, any Fanon algebra, any operator T. And you get even that these subspaces are hyperinvariant, and the trace of these subspaces, of the projection of these subspaces, is just given by the Brown measure, B. Hyperinvariant means that it's invariant on any operator in B of H that commute with a given operator T. Okay. This looks almost that one have solved the invariant subspace problem for 2-1 factors at least, but there is a catch, namely these spectral projections could be zero, just only be zero or one, and that happens if and only if the bound measure is concentrated in a single point. So I mean, if the bound measure is not concentrated in a single point, which is the case in many of the exams that have been concluded, then you know that there are lots of invariant subspaces. And this resolvent estimate come in because you want to find spectral projection, or in the first spectral eigenprocent, by forming such complex counterintegrals. And that a priori doesn't make sense if the curve cuts through the spectrum. But why that we do that, that we now comes this construction with this operator x divided by y, so let me skip it. So we just go to this big algebra where we have a star-free circular system x, y star-free from m, and then we simply consider this operator tn to 1. Okay, and then we get this resolvent estimate, and what these are good for is that there is, have been developed a method for integration in non-locally convex spaces. Actually, we invented it from scratch, but afterwards Piaget told us that this has a long history. It goes back to Turpin and Velpo, 1968, and Kalten cleated up. It was very messy written. Kalten cleated it up in 85. And it basically shows that I mean, there's nothing like a Lebesgue integral, but I mean, if you just want to integrate over intervals on the real line, you can do it if your function satisfies a certain Lipschitz condition. And that's exactly what we need this estimate for. So having this estimate, it makes it possible to make sense of this integral for this perturbed operator, and taking the spectral projections of this one, you will actually get the projection you want for not the P itself, but for this perturbed operator. And then finally you have to let n go into infinity, hope for the best, and that takes a lot of work also. Okay, I'll stop here. The original, what? Related to okay. Okay, so you wanted to know whether it's in the C star or what? I would certainly doubt that. I mean, even if you take a normal operator in the UHF algebra, and these spectral projections will be the good old ones for a normal operator. If you specialize in normal operator, and even if you take, spectral projections of a self-adjoint operator in a C-star algebra, they will not, in general, be in the algebra itself. So usually, be outside. Yeah, okay, of course, if you're real rank zero, lots of these projections will be actually in the algebra already, but not all of them, certainly. But yeah, okay, so you just want to know whether you can find a subspace which is given by a projection in the C-star algebra. Yeah, I would doubt that's correct in general, but I have no counterexample. Okay. Yeah, but I mean, no, if you take irreducible container UFF, you are in the B of H, they generate B of H for an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. No, and all this only works in the finite setting, in the finite trace. No, I mean, we have examples that we have, together with Ken Dyke and I have an example where this quasi-nilpotent DT operator, we have based on upper triangular, especially upper triangular random matrix model, and it turns out that he has a one parameter family of hyperinvariant subspaces, and then Dyke and Tutsi is, well, not really private, yeah.